Okay. All right. So thank you very much, Barry. It's not really actually a talk on anthropic principle, but rather I will mainly talking about the quark mass dependence, but there will be some connection to the anthropic principle. And so the idea is that we will have today two short talks. So I will give a kind of motivation and introduction into this business and tell you what is the connection with the anthropic principle, and then give you the job and give a talk, you know, on the calculation related with the coil state. Okay. All right. So short motivation. So the question is, well, we know quite a lot about the nuclear force, at least qualitatively. So it's a phenomenological picture in terms of meson exchange, large distances, one pion exchange, two pion exchange, some repulsive core. You may or may not believe in it, but that's a reasonable qualitative picture. And now, of course, the question is, okay, so what happens if the parameters of QCD would be a little bit different? So what happens if quark masses, so the light quark masses, would take different values? That's, of course, a very interesting question on its own. And actually, as far as I know, it was first asked, you know, in this context by Bulgak and collaborators, who thought that, well, maybe actually physics would be dramatically different at unphysical values of the quark masses. And they were primarily thinking about the 3p0 partial wave, which is with physical quark masses attractive, but the attraction is not large enough to produce a bound state. So they thought, okay, maybe if we vary, you know, quark masses, if we go to chiral limit, maybe the attraction will be large.
Yes. I think Jerry Brown already discussed in the 80s, I mean, you know, in the colorful world.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. So, yeah.
I was more referring to the effective field theory context.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Sure.
Just looking at varying, you know, sigma mass and the vector masses.
Right. What yeah, that's right. And of course, nowadays, you know, it's it still remains actually an open question, very interesting. And nowadays, latest QCD can really make calculations for heavier masses at the moment. And so this question is taken seriously by the LPCD collaboration. And also, together with finalist EFT practitioners, near and collaborators who match, you know, with NPL QCD calculations for light nuclei and try to extrapolate in the nuclear mass and see what happens with heavier nuclei. Now, there have been even more speculations related to the quark mass dependence. So, in principle, so what you see here in this picture, in this plot, are the inverse scattering lengths in the nuclear system. So those are S-wave scattering lengths in the spin triplet and spin singlet channel. I'm showing here inverse scattering lengths rather than the scattering lengths because it's actually more appropriate. So scattering lengths can go to infinity, but in fact, this just corresponds to a production of shallow bound state exactly at threshold. So it's actually more appropriate to look at the inverse quantities. So here you can see the physical point prime mass. That's a physical point in the 1S-naught channel, and you know, these bands are just possible chiral extrapolations based on chiral AFT. And you can see that in principle, nothing really forbids from first principles a situation in which you know, both of the inverse scattering lengths would turn to zero at some value of the quark mass, or both scattering lengths would simultaneously go to infinity. But that is, of course, a situation which would immediately cause, you know, the Efimov effects on nuclear physics would look dramatically different. So that is what is called infrared limit cycle. This possibility was mentioned by Bratton and Kammer, and we have also looked at it in a little bit more detail. Here you can see what will happen with the triton. So what you see here is the triton binding energy. Okay, And now you can see that if the point mass approaches here, this point, corresponding to the unitary limit, then you can see that's a threshold. And you can see that at some point, you will generate the second state. So that's a triton energy, it remains the same. But if you go close to the unitary limit, you'll generate a second state, it's an Efimov state. If you go even closer, then there will be the third Efimov state, and it is about the power of infinite number of bound states. That's very interesting and spectacular, of course. All right, so now what you also can do is to constrain possible time variation of the standard mode parameters. Of course, you know, to do this, what you need to do is you need to know the work mass dependence of the nuclear force. You need to have a decent theory of Big Bang S interest, and then you can produce the bounds by looking at the observed abundances of light. Finally, and that's actually the main topic of our talk today, is entropic considerations in connection with the Hoyle state. So what is Hoyle state? Hoyle state is the zero plus excited state in carbon 12, and that's a history a little bit. It was actually first predicted by Hoyle in 1953, when he spent actually, I guess, several months at the Kellogg Radiation Laboratory. And so he was actually looking at the production of carbon and heavier elements in stars, and then he has realized that, well, so this state was not known at this time. And then he realized that, well, he actually cannot get, you know, the observed amount of heavy elements. So he really needed to invent, you know, this resonance. And then he could describe all the data. And so he then went to experimentalists at this laboratory and suggested that they should look, you know, at and search for this state. And indeed, a few months later, state was discovered with pretty much exactly the same energy as predicted by Hoyle. Now, interestingly, Hoyle didn't manage to publish his prediction until this state was actually discovered. So if you look now in the literature at the publication, of course, you can check in Wikipedia, Hoyle state, you will see the reference is actually dated by 1954. And this is already after this state was discovered. But it's really unquestionable that he made, you know, this discovery, of course, before.
Did they not mention that in the Kellogg paper, that it was his idea that they looked for it?
As far as I know, they have even suggested to him to be a co-author of this paper, but he refused.
Okay, but he is acknowledged in there, so it is in the literature that he produced.
I think so.
Discussed it in this fashion, so it's clear he gets credit, right?
Yeah.
Well, there is, we know in this room, but everybody knows.
There is infinite amount of information, including biographies and, you know, review articles where this these things are presented in a proper way. So it's very well known that that's a prediction.
Yes, exactly.
It's just funny that he didn't publish it. Yes?
I wanted to ask about your first point. It seems to me that, maybe you'll discuss this more, but if we want to really invert these issues into a constraint and time variation of standard model parameters, why would we just consider the quark mass alone? Presumably, if we there's some tie to the cosmological expansion, fundamental parameters will vary simultaneously.
Sure.
We cannot look at them at one at a time.
I know
this is not your purpose, but I just maybe you had a
principle. Yes, I absolutely agree. Yeah, of course you can look at all possible parameters. That's correct.
But you know, for instance, if the down quark mass would be lighter than the up quark mass, no nuclei would exist.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, I mean,
okay, so
that you can, the cosmological constant can be whatever it would be, so it doesn't matter. Or alpha QD would not matter for that purpose. So that is a strict prediction.
But let me now come back to the oil state. Again, if you look in the literature, you will often hear that, you know, people tend to connect, you know, Hoyle's prediction to the anthropic principle, and you will be able even to find claims that that's a first prediction, really true prediction based on the anthropic principle, or even the only true prediction in a sense. It's interesting that Hoyle himself actually didn't make any connection with the anthropic principle, you know, at the beginning, I guess until 65, when he wrote a book and started, you know, moving towards anthropic considerations a little bit. So I really invite you to take a look at this interesting historical article, which is called Anthropic Myth, called Carbon 12 Resonance Level. And then you will find all the details and lots of discussions.
Why does one ever have to refer to an anthropic principle in this context? I mean, this is a science question, right?
Yeah.
Just a distraction.
Right.
And it wouldn't qualify by yesterday's definition, right?
Yeah. I think basically the discussion and connection with anthropic principle was intensified in the 80s. So when people started to discuss it in different contexts, in the context of string theory, and then they came back, you know, to this observation of oil state. And, okay, so now, now why is this state so famous? And of course, the answer, as we know, is that state plays a crucial role in the reaction rate for the triple alpha process, which goes all through beryllium 8 resonance. And so, if you take a look, you know, at the reaction rate, you can estimate it for this simple phenomenological formula, and you will see that, well, the crucial parameter in this formula is the energy difference between the Hoyle state and three times alpha particle energy. So it's not really this 7.7 MeV excitation energy of the Hoyle state above the ground state, but it's rather this energy difference, which is of the order of 380 keV. Actually, this point was also made by Weinberg, I guess, maybe in the 90s, where he pointed out that it's not really, you know, this excitation energy which plays a role of the control parameter, but it's the energy difference, which the energy of the alpha particle may in fact be correlated with the Hoyle state energy. And okay, so there had been calculations of people looking at, you know, the star dynamics and star evolution, and the statement is that if this control parameter would change, you know, by like 100 keV, then actually in both ways, so if it would be larger or smaller than this number, like 100 keV, then there would be either no sufficient production of carbon 12 or no sufficient production of oxygen. So this means that if we believe, you know, these simulations, then we would say, okay, we really need this energy difference to be around 380 keV in order that these elements which are necessary for life as we know it to be produced in sufficient amount. Okay. All right. Now, well, Hoyle state was predicted and observed a long time ago, but it remained to be a challenge, actually, for nuclear physics for decades. So the reason is very simple. The Hoyle state turns out to have a strongly clustered structure. So it's basically, you can think about it as a system of three alpha clusters in some sense. And so this state, if you do, you know, the normal many-body methods like shell model or no-core shell model, then people are forced to work in certain model space in these calculations in order to, you know, be able to treat this many-body problem.
But using shell model would not be good because you need like multi-cycle thermal relative is a cluster state.
That's exactly the point. Exactly because of this, so this cluster state doesn't really like to reside in the model space of this calculation. So it was really a challenge to calculate first principles. So this has been solved in the latest calculations. And Dean will be talking about this. And of course, if you are able to describe these states up initio as a set of 12 nucleons, then the next question would be, okay, how stable is actually this energy difference or the excitation energy of the coil state relative to the variation of the fundamental parameters like work masses or maybe the alpha, so the electromagnetic constant. And that is actually the main question of our talks, and we will be concentrating on the variation of the work masses. So everything will be done from this point. Everything will be done in the limit of exact isospin symmetry, and the way to approach this question of the robustness with respect to variation of light work masses would be by using effective field theory, chiral effective field theory. So it's already introduced in many talks. This boils down to the essential non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, and we have now chiral expansion for the interactions. And what you should do now is you simply have to solve this equation, and then you have to take into account the dependence of various quantities like the nucleon mass and the interactions themselves on the quark masses. Okay, so that's what you need to do. And if you're able to do this, then you will calculate the quark mass dependence of the resulting energies. Now, people doing such calculations usually prefer to work in terms of the so-called k factors. So these are just dimensionless slopes of a given observable around the physical point. Okay. Now, if you take a look at the various ingredients on the left-hand side of the Schrödinger equation, then the work mass dependence on the k factor of the nuclear mass is, of course, pretty well known from latest calculations, but also from chiral perturbation theory. Then the long range part of the interaction, well, it's mainly the one-pion exchange. So again, the quark mass dependence of the one-pion exchange is known, of course, reasonably well. Again, especially by latest QCD calculations. Now, the problem is that the short range part of the nuclear force, we don't really have much information about the final quark mass dependence of the short-range radius.
Yeah, I just have a question. I was mindful on the previous slide you're remarking that the coil state energy has very different outcomes if it shifts by 100 keV.
Yes.
Now, as soon as you say that, then I think this is a very interesting exercise nonetheless, but would we not think it's quite possible that if we were to fix the up-down quark mass difference to the physical value and then vary the overall scale, you might end up with very different conclusions in regards to the sensitivity of the quark mass. Yes?
But that's exactly what we want to. That's exactly what we want to investigate.
I'm saying isospin breaking, because 100 keV, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, electromagnetic mass shifts, up down quark mass differences.
Yeah.
I think you've looked at a very special loci point somehow.
So what you're talking about would be basically a three-dimensional plot of the energy with respect to the sum of the two quark masses and difference of the two quark masses.
Or I would
what
say
we are
that
doing at the moment is just a projection onto the isospin.
So really, I would say that if we imagine that somehow a time dependence is coming from time dependence in the Higgs vacuum excitation value, then it's maybe kind of reasonable to think that you shift the overall scale, but the difference might be be more or less fixed.
Yeah, I fully agree. So the result in the idle spin limit, that's just one particular case. In principle, you have another dimension in the problem by increasing the differences between the up and down flows. We have not done this investigation, but in principle, it can be done, of course. We have not yet went that far. And
you are lucky that helium and carbon has the same proton to neutron relation, right? And
right.
That helps.
Well,
I'm really lucky. It's only the neutron part.
But the point is that, so you can. You can, of course, always in the future you can repeat, do the analysis by relaxing this constraint. That's not what we have done. Fully agree with you. It would be interesting to look at. But as you will see, it's even not so.
I'm just remarking that I'm not sure how the conclusions would change. I just wonder if they would be sensitive.
As you will see, even for this particular case, the conclusions, unfortunately, are not that stringent, mainly due to the lack of information about the quark mass dependence of the short-range interaction. So you can do much more sophisticated interactions allowing idle spin breaking effects and whatever, but at least at this stage, it will not really bring you much new insights, I guess. But it's definitely something one should do in the future.
So, because of the first two points, for example, if you wanted to add the quark mass difference there, so for the K factor of the nuclear mass, this is going to be extremely tiny compared to the uncertainties in the sigma term, even there, advantage. And then for the long range force, the difference in the prior masses at leading orders of completely of electromagnetic origin, so that the quark mass difference wouldn't even enter. So as far as the first two points are concerned, I don't even...
But you raise an excellent point that electromagnetic explosions are also quite
good. I think the statement is that here we are looking actually quite a small, quite small energy differences. And so you might think that, well, even small effects, if those differences are not correlated, then even small effects might produce large impact.
Yeah, but then it might be more important to look at the variation in alpha instead of the quark mass.
Yes, that's what you have done.
Yeah. This talk we're focusing on the light quarks.
All right. So So basically, that's really the problem. So that's not under control now, and instead of dealing with contact interactions, it's maybe a little bit more elegant to express our results in terms of at least potentially observable quantities which are given by these derivatives of the inverse scattering lengths in its singlet case, triplet case with respect to the prime mass at the physical point. So these are two quantities which we need in our analysis in order to make conclusions about the sensitivity of the energy with respect to the variation. And unfortunately, as I will show you in the next couple of transparencies, the current information is not very precise. So what we will do, or what Dean will describe, would be just do calculations and express all results in terms of these parameters in order to be model independent, which means that in the future, you will be always able to plug in the numbers, the relevant numbers, and get the conclusions. Okay.
What about the three-body force?
Three-body force is actually next to leading quarter effect, and we have in fact looked at the contribution of the work mass dependence of the three-body force. I don't know if Dean will be talking about this, but our conclusion was that compared to the work mass dependence at leading quarter, which we are explicitly including, the effect is very small, just consistent with the power count. Okay, so now, how do we actually get this information about the quark mass dependence of the scattering lengths? Of course, lattice QCD, so that's a primary source of information. There were already several talks on lattice QCD in this meeting. that current situation is not quite sure whether it's complete. Yeah, well, it's 2015, so the plot is taken from by Yamazaki. Here you can see that one is not channel, three is one channel. That's a physical point, physical prime mass, deuteron. There is a bounded state, and that one is not channel. So you can see that most of the calculations tend to suggest more attraction in both channels. But as we heard, there are also speculations, or actually the result by the HELQC collaboration, that they don't see bound states at all. So I guess the situation is not really completely clear at the moment. And of course, this raises a question whether one can maybe do something in effective field theory when waiting more precise results from QCD. Well, this indeed has been done. And historically, that's our calculations by our group with Wolf and by Silas and Martin. More than 10 years ago, you can see, well, you can actually do calculations, but the uncertainty of your results is huge. So what is shown here are results for the binding energy, physical point, huge uncertainty. Of course, the reason for this huge uncertainty is the lack of information about M-pi dependence or the short-range interaction. So you have to do some eight-dimensional analysis, but it's very uncertain, of course.
When you go too much higher bound masses, your counting of NLO, N square low.
Fully agree. Yeah. So the question is up to what point masses you can go. So I would optimistically expect that you might be able to go to double, so like 300 MeV with large uncertainties, but even that might be questionable. Now, on the other hand, of course, if you just do, you know, leading quarter kind of calculation, kind of interfield theory for nuclear system, well, then your interaction is just one pion exchange plus two quantum terms. And in this case, of course, you know, at leading quarter, the only source of quark mass dependence is this pion propagator. So everything is predictable. Is a prediction at leading quarter, no parameters. And so we have done these calculations with Jumbo in this more elegant, renormalizable approach. So that's an equation which is a kind of relativistic generalization of the Lippmann-Schwinger equation. The nice thing is that it's only logarithmically divergent, so we can safely take lambda to infinity, no cutoff anymore. And here you can see the red lines, that's our result. So that's inverse one is not scattering lines, 3S1, and the binding energy. So you can see that the calculation suggests that the neutron becomes less bound if you go to heavier quark masses. So the simple explanation or qualitative explanation of this observation is fairly simple. So if you think about the one-point exchange potential, that's tensor interaction, of course. Okay, but as we know, deuteron resides mainly in the 3S1 channel. It's mainly S-wave state. So this means that we can, in fact, effectively describe the deuteron if we project out the tensor potential onto the S-wave potential. Okay, and the corresponding effective potential would emerge from the first iteration of the one-point exchange. So you go from S state via one-point exchange to the 3D1 state, and then you go back to the 3S1 state. This will generate an effective S-wave potential, which turns out to be attractive. Okay? But this means that, well, if the potential is attractive, if you increase the plant mass, well, and of course, at higher point masses, you miss this attraction, so you get less attraction, and that's exactly what we see. Okay.
What about GA and FI in this context?
They're right here, but I will come to
this. The physical values.
Yeah. So we have taken at leading quarters, so the variation of GA would be 1 plus M pi squared. So that's already a subleading effect, which is not considered here. But I will come to this question later. Of course, that's just a leading quarter result. So what is uncertainty? Well, we have then reinvented the regulator in this equation in order to estimate the uncertainty. We see that, you know, varying lambda, we get sizable uncertainty, as we would expect. But the tendency is actually still the same. So it sort of like to produce less attraction in the triplet channel if you go to heavier work masses. Can you do better than the leading quarter calculation? So we tried to extend these results to next to leading quarter. But then the problem, of course, is that you have even more short-range operators with unknown endpoint dependence. So you have to do some modeling in order to have an idea about the endpoint dependence. And this is exactly what we have done. So in this paper, we have actually modeled the endpoint dependence of the short-range operators in terms of resonance saturation. It is, so in order to give you an idea of how this works, here you can see the results of the physical point mass. And so these are the values of the relevant short-range operators for different values of the regulator. So those are obtained by fits to NN data. Now, if you consider saturation with sigma, rho, and omega mesons, then you find those values, and you can see, well, they sort of describe reasonably the short-range interactions.
Do you fix the coupling constants?
Of what?
Of the slope.
Of these mesons. Yeah. Well, this is a so-called bond B model, but we have also looked at other one boson exchange models available on the market. And we have not done any modeling by ourselves, but just taken, you know, various models. And so now the idea is, of course, okay, but if this works for physical point mass, and if you will assume that it will also work for unphysical point masses, then you can actually take a look at how the pole position of, for example, the rho meson will change with the variation of the work masses. And this has been studied, of course, on the lattice, but also in unitarized chiral perturbation theory. So we use this input in modeling of the work mass dependence, and that's what we end up with. So the important picture is again the neutron binding energy. So this band is our result, and the band itself corresponds only to the variation of the cutoff in the Schrodinger equation. This, of course, by no means measures the uncertainty of the resonance saturation, which is difficult to estimate. So it's just modeling beyond effective field theory. But you can see, so here the dotted line, that's the previous results which I have shown to you in the infinite lambda limit. Pretty consistent result. Again, essentially the same tendency. And even if you compare this with more phenomenological calculations from Baum and Wieringer, they actually find pretty much the same thing. So that's a neutron binding energy. Looks pretty much the same. Okay.
In your resonance saturation model, you vary the mass of the rows and sigmas. But you wouldn't know the coupling itself.
We do not vary coupling constant. That's correct.
But, I mean, if you think about the rho, I mean, that becomes a stable particle at some point.
Right.
There's big uncertainty in doing it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, and it's a big uncertainty, you know, assuming that resonance saturation works. So it's very, it's model dependent.
How do you even deal with the imaginary path in this context?
So
how do you even deal with the imaginary path in this context? So I'm amazed that the sigma saturation works so amazingly well.
Yeah, so, well, there are, of course, assumptions. Of course, you know, in this one boson exchange models, sigma is viewed basically as a not really as an unstable particle. It's parametrized, you know, by a sort of a stable meson.
Yeah, but then, of course, the question is, why should this have anything to do with what these people calculated in unitarized KPT? because that is really...
I agree with you. So there are, of course, you know, dramatic assumptions here. Yeah.
This is a, based on these uncertainties. It's really amazing how well this works.
Yeah, so there are...
The
sigma is simply fitted.
The question is about the work mass.
Completely.
Yeah. I agree. Okay. So now let me, in the last minute, let me just flash you yet more recent development. So this is work done with Vadim Barlow, Arsim Pivin, and Jean-Luc Degelia, where we are looking actually at the low energy theorems, which I have also already mentioned in my tutorial in this workshop. So the idea is that actually the low energy behavior of the amplitude is largely determined by the long-range interaction, which manifests itself in the left-hand discontinuity, so the scattering amplitude. Okay, so if you are able to calculate these discontinuities, which are governed by the one-pion exchange, then you can reconstruct the strongly varying energy dependence of scattering amplitude, and this would manifest itself, for example, in correlations between coefficients in the effective range expansion, and those correlations are referred to as low energy theorems. You can see that they work really very well in the 3S1 channel, where the one-pion interaction is important at the physical point, and now you can go off the physical point, start varying the quark masses of pion mass. This will, of course, mainly shift the thresholds, but also change the discontinuity across the left-hand cuts. And now the idea is that you can calculate what happens, you know, with the discontinuity of the left-hand cuts, different values of the pion mass, but you still need one piece of short-range information in order to fix, you know, the arbitrary MPI dependence of the short-range physics. Okay, and the idea is that you can use any information like binding energy or any low-energy observable, and once you have it, so basically you go to arbitrary value of the pion mass, and you need one low-energy observable for nuclear scattering. This will provide the necessary information to fix the short-range part of the interaction, and then you can do extrapolation in energy which are based on assuming that the long-range dynamics is governed by the one-pion exchange. So that's the whole idea. And this can be used, you know, to make extrapolations in energy at any fixed value of MPI, but remember that you always need one amount of information in order to determine the short-range physics. Now you can start playing various games. So this is one exercise that we have done. So you can see here NPL QCD calculation of the effective range in the 3S1 channel, 800 MeV. And then Martin and collaborators have suggested that, well, it's maybe not unreasonable to assume, you know, that this quantity MPI times the effective range is slowly varying, basically linear extrapolation down to the physical point. Now, if you take this seriously, this will provide you the necessary input at any fixed value of the pion mass, and that's exactly what we need in these low energy theorems. So we can now take this as input in our calculation and see what will happen with all the other observables that we have, especially the binding energy. If you do this, then the low energy theorems immediately tell you the following behavior of the binding energies, which seems to be compatible with the trend of latest QCD data, actually. And now if you take a look, if you take again this extrapolation, of course you can also calculate the slope of the scattering length in the triplet channel, and you will see that it has now different sign compared to the results which I have shown to you before, and small uncertainty. But remember, this uncertainty is only the uncertainty associated with this band, the latest QCD data, and with the uncertainty of low energy theorems. But this uncertainty, of course, does not take into account the assumption about the linear extrapolation, which is beyond. Okay? So this is not the real, you know, theoretical uncertainty of these calculations, of course. So I'm done with my transparencies, and that's a kind of overview. So we don't actually have precise information about these parameters AS and AT, and using boson saturation, we get, you know, an estimation of these parameters, and those estimations are compatible with the leading chiral perturbation theory prediction, and also with phenomenological results. On the other hand, the existing lattice QCD calculations combined with new energy theorems tend to produce, you know, for this AT different values, you know, even the sign is wrong. So what we really need is more input from lattice QCD and especially near the physical point. So now Dean will use, you know, this AS and AT to show what happens.
Before you go on, can,
yes,
I,
okay,
can I ask?
Sure, yes.
You can also just simply do an M pi squared extrapolation of the effective range. I'm just curious if you tried that and how much that changed the...
Yeah. We have done this. Let me see if I have a slide on this. So just for fun of it, we have also done this exercise assuming that, you know, it's not linear with M pi, but it's maybe linear with a quark mass. This will produce this plot. Now again, using this input, we can see what happens with the binding energies. That's what happens.
So it goes up much faster.
Yeah.
About two-pion exchange processes. I mean, at LLO, you get analytic expressions as a function of pion mass for some of the two-pion exchange processes, the important ones, right?
Yes.
So, why can't one just remove at least part of the model dependence that is put in by discussing sigmas and rho exchange or so from the boson exchange point of view, by just replacing it by the next to leading order two pion exchanges, which take over a large part of this, and discuss the pion mass dependence there, where one has analytic expressions?
That's actually what we have done with this calculation. So this calculation is at the level of M2LO, which means that the long range part of the interaction, it's one pion exchange plus leading two pion exchange plus sub-leading two pion exchange. And there, of course, we take, you know, into account all the endpoint dependence as we know.
But then I don't understand the numbers that you put in for sigma and rho, for example.
Okay, so those numbers refer to the saturation of short-range interactions, right? So these are things like, for example, so that's...
So you discuss this explicitly in R space?
We actually try to get an idea of how, you know, these operators depend on M pi. So that's a problem, short-range operators.
But the bond B potential doesn't know about explicit two-pi exchange
processes. Right. So when we do matching, when we go from, you know, from rho, sigma, and omega to these numbers, we are subtracting out the explicit effects of the two-pi exchange in order to avoid double counting. Okay. This is taken into account.
Please, low energy theorems you've talked about at the end. How do you know that the quark mass variation of a single short-range parameter is enough to capture all of the short-range quark mass dependence?
That's a good question. So when talking about the... low-energy theorems, what we have done is we have also explicitly included the short-range the anti-dependence of a subleading interaction and apply, you know, assume that it varies in the relatively large range. So that's actually what we have done. We have modeled it by introducing kind of Hale-Mason exchange of this form, which for low values of Q squared reduces, of course, to short-range interactions. And then what we have done is we have allowed for a variation of this strength in such a way that it varies by plus or minus 100% when we go to n pi squared of the order of 0.25 GeV. So this variation was motivated by looking at how all the other quantities like Ga, F pi, so what is the size of the quark mass dependence in those quantities. And basically the results that I have shown, there were these bands corresponding to the variation within plus or minus 50%. They will produce blue bands, you know, in the figures that I have shown, but we have also a more conservative variation of plus or minus 100%. So what you see is, of course, if you go to larger planet masses, then, you know, at some point the uncertainty becomes 100% and you cannot make predictions anymore. But in this region, I think it's quite under control.
So is this NLO variation one of the bands in the earlier plot?
Exactly, correct. So this the band of the same color corresponds to exactly this variation. So band in the, you know, the band. That's exactly this effect.
So if you take the HELP QCD results and to just integrate out in momentum, you can reduce it to something that looks like what you're dealing with here, with short-range constants plus a pi until. If you do that, or have you done that, and is it consistent with what you...
Well, I have actually, a couple of times, I have suggested to all the sons that we can actually test their results.
Exactly.
If they would provide us some information, so we are open.
But you haven't, it hasn't been done?
Not yet.
Okay, that seems like the obvious step.
Is the mic working? Oh, it's not actually amplifying, it's just recording. Not for us. Okay, so Evgeny gave actually a very, very nice deduction to a lot of the things I'll talk about. So I can go quickly and I'll just focus on the things that are new. So these are, I'll talk about the lattice simulations using chiroelectric field theory applied to the Hoyle state in this question of the light quark mass dependence. So, The basic technique is that we have protons and neutrons on our lattice, space-time lattice, with a lattice spacing on the order of about 1 to 2 Fermi. And then we do simulations where we have interactions defined by chiral effective field theory placed on this lattice, where the lattice itself plays the role of the ultraviolet regulator. Okay, so we have the usual 1-pion exchange, contact interactions at leading order, 2-pion exchange, and higher derivative contact interactions at higher orders. So in order to do these calculations, first of all, we have to tune the unknown coefficients to scattering observables, right, for the short-range contact interactions, for example. But once we've done that, we have a representation on our lattice of low-energy nuclear physics. And then what we do is we do simulations using Euclidean time projection. So I discussed this in my talk earlier in this program, but basically the main engine that we use is the exponential minus h tau. Tau is what's called the Euclidean time. So the idea here is that as tau gets large, you are killing the high energy modes and you're only seeing the low energy states of your quantum system. And so that's the basic way any quantum Monte Carlo calculation works. Now, since H contains the kinetic energy operator, which is minus del squared over 2m, when you exponentiate plus del squared over 2m tau, this actually is a diffusion operator. Okay, and so you can model diffusion exactly with particles doing random walks in space. So you can think of them that the nucleons are doing random walks in space as a function of this Euclidean time parameter. So we have some initial time, and we have some final time, and we can calculate then with some initial state and some final state, some quantum mechanical amplitude, and that's how the simulation works. Now, in order to actually run this on a computer, though, we make use of the auxiliary field method, which is basically rewriting the interactions. Let's say we have a simple two-body interaction like this, n degree n squared. We need to do things like the exponential of minus h tau. So we take this term in the Hamiltonian, or Lagrangian if you want to think that way. Then we have the exponential of something times n degree n squared. You can think of this as a Gaussian function. But you know that you can write this Gaussian function as another Gaussian, but this time a Gaussian integral. We have an integral over an extra variable s, which is called the auxiliary variable, or this will actually be an auxiliary field for every point in space and time. If you do the integral of this Gaussian function, notice that there's a linear shift in the quadratic form. You know how to do that integral. You complete the quadratic form, make it a perfect square, and that recovers exactly this term. You integrate over s, and that cancels the 1 over square root of 2 pi. The reason this is useful is that instead of having n degree n squared, you have n degree n, which makes it a one-body operator. So instead of having the nucleons talk to each other, you have the nucleons interacting only with the auxiliary field. So we do this at every point in space and time, and now the nucleons are, instead of interacting with each other, they're interacting with the auxiliary field at that space-time point. And in this way of thinking of things, the pion is like an auxiliary field, except it has correlations in space that come from the exchange of the one pion exchange and higher pion exchange. In order to calculate the amplitude, because we've used these auxiliary fields, the nucleons have decoupled from each other. So we can calculate a single nucleon amplitude from an initial nucleon J going to a final nucleon I. And that we'll get a matrix then of amplitudes that will be a function of the auxiliary fields. S maybe is an auxiliary field coupled to total nucleon density. Si is maybe an auxiliary field coupled to isospin, and this is our pion. To get the full amplitude of the system, let's say we have an A-body system, an A-nucleon system, then this will be an A by A matrix, and the full amplitude will be a product of all the single nucleon amplitudes and anti-symmetrized sum, which is just the determinant. So the algorithm is basically to calculate this determinant for all possible values of the auxiliary field. Yeah.
Oh, I just have a trivial question. Sure. Is the auxiliary field trick useful even if C were not manifestly negative definite?
You still use it. It's a problem. This is the origin of the sine problem.
So this is a sine problem in this context.
Yeah, in this context. With attractive interactions, the general rule is that if there's a pairing channel, that then C is negative. There's some way in which things can pair either in either the spin singlet or the spin triplet channel. And in that case, there typically is no sine problem. However, if you have repulsive interactions, then there's no way of writing it in terms of pure attractive pairing channels, then you have to deal with the sine problem. But there's tricks around it. But
ultimately, it's a technical point of signal to noise, I guess.
Yeah. So if you have a problem where there's not much pairing, you have a very frustrated system, and this is where the sine problem will hurt you.
So in the general case, you have a sine problem. So how do you deal with it?
In the general case, I don't have a solution, but what helps a lot is that there's an approximate Wigner SU4 symmetry, which gives you these pairing channels and the symmetries. And so.
But what do? You ignore the.
No, we don't ignore anything. We just defeat it with high statistics. That's where all our supercomputing time goes into making high statistics when the average sine. We can go down to.
But currently, it's for very large scale.
So what we do is we actually make the initial states very highly improved. So we do tricks like the following. We take, so when we propagate in time, we, in the beginning, we start off with a theory that has more symmetries, that has an exact SU4 symmetry. So we can generate a nucleus that has the SU4 symmetry, Wigner SU4 symmetry, and there's no sign problem. So now then we essentially can cool into the ground state of this Wigner SU4 symmetric theory, which is no sign problem, and then we kick, then we turn on the real interactions, and it doesn't require a lot of tau to get to the ground state that way. That's the trick we use. Okay.
I mean, there's another method we've used many years ago. I mean, you take the bed sign component.
Yeah, extrapolation.
You tell the sign and then do extrapolation.
Usually,
it's very smooth extrapolation.
Yeah, we've looked at your work. We've done similar things, where we take a theory that has an SU4 symmetry with attractive interactions, and then our physical interactions, and then we interpolate between the two theories and try to smoothly connect the two. Similar idea. Okay, so what's nice about this technique is that, as Evgeny mentioned, we get clustering very easily. There's no problems with getting all types of clustering formations. And so that's why we are focusing on the Hoyle state, which is very difficult by other methods. So let's first just show you some of our results. This was the state of the art back in these years here. So the calculation of the ground state of carbon-12, we use two different initial states to make sure we get a plateau that's consistent with, that seems consistent with both of them to show that we have some control over the extrapolation. Here is the Euclidean time. Here is the energy as a function of the Euclidean time. And then you can calculate, that's at leading order. Then you can calculate the corrections you get from the isospin symmetric next to leading order corrections, the corrections you get from the electromagnetic and isospin breaking corrections, and actually the N to a low corrections as well. You add them up. It's a 1 point. Yeah, this was done on 1.97 Fermi lies, rather coarse.
Can you try to change the,
This we can do now. Now we're doing simulations with smaller, but this was the way we did it then. So at leading order, by the way, this leading order calculation is a misnomer. We actually have promoted some terms to NLO. From NLO into this improved leading order calculation, simply to make the convergence of this go a bit faster, since we're actually going to use perturbation theory. And so you can see by the time we get to next leading order, it's actually in reasonable agreement with experiment. Now we can do better simulations with not such a large error bar, and probe this a bit better. But it's doing reasonably well. Then you can take a look at not just the first zero, not just the ground state, the zero plus state, but the second zero plus state. So you can actually do this several ways. The cheapest way to do this is by actually trying a bunch of different initial states of different geometries. We actually take alpha clusters in different geometries, just wave packets in different shapes. And you can see that for some shapes, it actually plateaus to the ground state energy that we calculated before quite quickly. But if we take other shapes, there seems to be another plateau that's a bit higher. Now, if we were to extend this out further, then eventually it would fall down into the ground state. But what we see is that there's a plateau here. Now, if that's not completely convincing, then you can do a more careful analysis where you do a coupled channel calculation where you have two states that are, both have zero plus symmetry, and then you can orthogonalize with respect to the ground state to make sure you actually have a second zero plus state. But no matter which way you do it, you find that there's another zero plus state.
And so is this all done in an alpha clustering model?
Oh, it's not a model. The alpha clustering is simply in the initial state. So we use the motivation of the alpha clusters to make a wave packets, but then we do the full microscopic, full ab initio calculation.
So is that equivalent to having all 12 nucleons of all possible space-time points?
In the full simulation, the nucleons can be anywhere, any lattice site, yeah. There's no fixing of clusters or anything. In other words, you start them up in alpha clusters, but then you just let them go. They do anything. Yeah.
So your alpha clustering is just some initial unsox.
Exactly.
Okay, and then you let it evolve.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, the problem we had, though, was to, in order to figure out what is the alpha cluster structure we see, because it's a 12-body system, it's kind of hard to figure that out. At the time, we use the initial states and the overlaps we get with the ground state or the Hoyle state to try to figure out the dominant structure. So in other words, we then look back at the initial states and ask the question, okay, we have different initial states that give me the ground state, that give me the excited state. Which one gives me the ground state? Which one gives me the excited state? And that's how we figure it out.
I mean, if you don't force the orthogonality to the ground state, eventually
it all falls down to the ground state.
Yeah, so you realize somehow when you get some metastables.
Exactly. So you cook up the geometry, so it takes a long time for it to find the ground state, but it's very happily found something else. That's the idea. Now, as I said, that might not be convincing because you can fool yourself, but you can do a couple channel analysis and orthogonalize with respect to the ground state and force it to find another state. Then you can get a better plateau that way.
So alpha cluster modeling in nuclear physics, it was a big deal 50 years ago.
Yes.
But, you know, they're sort of disreputable because, you know, they have really little to do with a real nucleus like this.
Yeah.
But you know carbon 12 is more or less an LS ground state, so you could write down much better ansatzes for
it. So we're not using the alpha cluster model in any way. We just simply, our initial state is motivated by that.
I'm just wondering why you didn't pick, you know, a more reasonable initial state, maybe.
Well, the thing is, we can't get the Hoyle state that way. The Hoyle state requires the alpha cluster. So. Yeah, this is why.
I mean, this method only filters the ground state. You have to get excited state, you have to do some better. I mean,
Yeah. You need four particle, four hole excitations to get the Hoyle state to work. Yeah. Okay, so what we see in the sense of, and I'll tell you at the end of this how we're doing it now, how we can do this much better. But basically, we see a strong overlap for the ground state in the first 2+ state if we make a compact triangular configuration of alpha clusters for the initial state. Okay, and then to get the second 0+ state, we need something that's more extended, what we call the bent arm type configuration. So something a little bit more elongated. Not a linear chain, but actually something sort of elongated. Okay, so that's to motivate that we actually have some control. We have some control over the excited state. So you can see our comparison at N to a low for our first 2+ state, our second 0+ state, comparing with experiment, and actually the second 2+ state, which seems to be rotational excitation of the Hoyle state. All right, so now that we have...
three-body forces are in.
Yeah, three-body forces are here. And two LO.
And three LO, four-body forces would come
yeah,
in.
Yeah, we did do that. We haven't done that calculation. We can do all these calculations. It's just a matter of time and effort. Yeah, we haven't gone to that stage.
We have something for the oxygen.
Sure. Okay. So now, to go back to the main question, I just want to show that the calculations are under some control. The question of the light quark mass depends on helium burning, so the triple alpha process in the Hoyle state, and actually the next step of alpha capture on carbon 12. I'm not going to tell you that calculation. That's a hard one. That's something we're trying to do as well, but I'll tell you what I'm going to say about that. Okay, so the triple alpha rate, Evgeny showed you this formula already. There's a huge exponential sensitivity to this parameter epsilon. The reason the epsilon is defined this way, the Hoyle energy minus the triple alpha, is because these are the initial and the final states. And so you can imagine the intermediate steps don't really matter because they give you Boltzmann factors that will cancel out. Okay. So the question is whether this epsilon is in a range that is hospitable for the possibility of carbon based life. So is nature fine-tuned? So epsilon is approximately 380 kiloelectron volts. And if any mentioned this from the Oberhammer paper, that's this here, that if epsilon is 100 kV above that value, the physical value, then you'll have some problems. In particular, you'll have a low carbon abundance. You can understand that very simply. You don't get the resonance enhancement that you usually get. But even so for a given red giant star, you make the epsilon a bit bigger. You don't get enough carbon in the triple alpha rate. However, you can imagine maybe there's a bigger star that will go to a higher temperature, and then in that case, you would actually produce the carbon. But in that case, it will be produced at higher temperatures, and what will happen is that the carbon will get destroyed, and it will go on to heavier elements. So that doesn't really give you what you need. So epsilon should not be above about 400 kV. Now, if epsilon is 100 kV below the physical value, then you have no problem with carbon production. The problem here, though, is that the carbon production will occur at a lower temperature, And so what will happen is there's not enough energy then in the next step for the alpha capture on carbon to produce enough oxygen. So that's the problem there. And if you think oxygen is just as important for carbon, then you're kind of in trouble for carbon-based life as well. Okay. So there's a sweet spot. Sorry? Okay. So there's a sweet spot in this range, 380 kV plus or minus 100 kV. And so we're going to look at the dependence by looking at the Hoyle state energy that depends on the light quark masses, and we'll parameterize it in terms of the pion mass. And so Evgeny did all the hard work on this, so I can go a bit quickly through this. So you can think about the coupling, the GA coupling here, but there's not very much dependence actually at all. But there is going to be a mpi dependence from one pion exchange. There'll be some dependence of the nuclein mass upon mpi, as well as the short range interactions here. And that's where a lot of the uncertainty really lies here, which Evgeny talked about. So you can take a look at these papers here. Okay, so then we did a whole bunch of calculations of the sensitivity of all kinds of things upon essentially on all the parameters. So we took the leading order chiral EFT interactions and just said, what is the dependence of these energies upon all the parameters in our leading order interactions? And so you don't have to, I'm just showing six of the calculations we did. We did about 20, 30 separate calculations on this. So you don't have to follow the details. We just need to extrapolate to what happens at infinite time to get what happens for these states. And so let me parameterize it this way. Okay, so EH, H for Hoyle. So delta EH is going to be the Hoyle state energy minus the brilliant H plus alpha threshold. Okay. That's to distinguish it from epsilon, which is Hoyle relative to the triple alpha threshold. And then the brilliant H value, the difference between the brilliant H and the double alpha threshold will be a delta EB. So now you can calculate from the simulations what you get of the derivative of delta EH, this guy, with respect to m pi at the physical point. And then we get this formula here, where there's a lot of uncertainty in what's going on with the short range operators. So I will leave these as AS bar for the singlet and for the AT bar for the triplet. I will put in the best values later, but just to show you, because these are the ones with the most uncertainty, I'll write in this form. Now, if you do the same thing for delta EB, derivative with respect to the pion mass, you get this result here. Now, if you take epsilon, derivative with respect to mpi, you get this expression here. Now, if you stare at this for a while, you'll notice that they're actually almost proportional to each other. Okay? There's actually a approximate linear relationship between the two. So you can actually make a plot, like, yeah.
For E alpha also.
For E alpha, and I didn't. I'm going to actually use that in a moment, but I'm not showing you the results there.
But we have not a correlation between these
three. Sure. You can make some combination and extract E alpha from your combination. But here's a plot. So here's the E alpha. Okay, the derivative of the alpha binding energy with respect to m pi. And you plot the other guys, the delta EB, beryllium with respect to 2 alpha, Hoyle with respect to beryllium A plus alpha, and Hoyle with respect to triple alpha. And you see they're all very strongly correlated with the alpha binding energy. Okay. So that may be surprising that you might have thought that these all moved in different ways, and there needs to be some sort of fine-tunings to make these under control. However, it seems like there is a one-parameter family going on here, which is actually not incredibly surprising if you think that these are alpha cluster states. They're all alpha cluster states, and perhaps it's just the property of the alpha clusters that determines what's going on. So from that point of view, that makes some sense. Okay? So the more binding you get for the alpha particle, the stronger that the alpha particles actually stick together is what we find. All right, so now here's the main result that we get. And so I was debating to change the name of this plot, but I changed it back to the original name. So this is our end of the world plot. So now what you can do is you can say, all right, we're going to change the quark masses by, let's say, 1% or 5%. If you are in the shaded region, you're safe. If you are not in the shaded region, you have trouble. Okay? So if you change the quark masses by 1%, then if the physical point for these relatively unconstrained parameters, the AT bar and the AS bar, so the best values that Evgeny mentioned is this point here with rather large error bars. So this is the thing that lattice TCD in principle can nail for us. You see that we seem to be okay for a 1% change. We're in the safe zone. For a 5% change, not so clear. Okay, one needs more precision. Now, I should mention, though, if you are thinking that a T bar is 0.3, the point is more around here, so it's off the band. So there's a question whether you're taking, whether the deuteron is getting left bound with increasing quark mass or it's getting more bound, which will move over there. So that's actually a very interesting question. Okay. Now,
do you worry about the resonance strength itself ought to change in some really complicated way?
You mean the width?
Yeah.
Well, but the thing is, we're thinking simply about the carbon production. So it's mainly that Boltzmann factor that's the dominant role. It shouldn't be such a big.
Well, for beryllium, it's independent because you just produce the resonance. For carbon, I would assume you have to have no resonance.
Well, if you look at the original formula, that was not. I mean, the gamma width is important, but it's not the huge dependence is just simply the exponential dependence of the alpha on epsilon here that's dominating. But yes, certainly resonance properties will make a contribution.
But the width you cannot calculate.
Yeah, we haven't calculated that. That's a hard calculation. That's something we're trying to do in the future. But okay, but now let me just tell you what we're working on now. So that was kind of the state of the art a few years back. Those calculations in 2011, 12, 13. What we're doing now is we're working on proof simulations of the full low energy spectrum of carbon-12, all of the states on the low energy spectrum with small lattice spacings. And now we're using more general initial states composed of alpha cluster as well as particle hole excitations above the ground state. So now what we can do is just essentially any initial state you can dream up, we can now do. But what's very exciting is in actually just the last week, we finally figured out something that we thought was probably impossible, but now we can do. So let me explain the situation. So when we do auxiliary field, Jorm does this, I do auxiliary fields. It's a very powerful method in that you get superpositions of all possible quantum states. You essentially integrate out the nucleons and you get all possible quantum states associated with some auxiliary fields. So it's very powerful. However, you give up something. Now, because we're doing a fully ab initio calculation where all of the nucleons are simulated, we give up the actual question of where are the nucleons. We never measure them. We get a superposition of everything. So in particular, we don't know where the center of mass is. Okay. Because we get a superposition of all the center of masses, a bunch of center masses. However, we now have an algorithm that actually can compute that. And the way we're doing that, and it seems to be working quite nicely now, is we calculate an A-body density for an A-nucleus state. So the way we simulate that is we have an initial state, we have a final state. In the middle, what we do is we actually insert a rho of R1 times rho of R2 times rho of R up to RA. Where rho is the density operator, okay? And you can do normal ordering, so the normal order product of that. If you integrate over all values R1, R2 to RA, it's going to give you the identity times A factorial, because it will just simply, select the A particles in some order. Now what we can do is we can actually do simulations of that, if you want, in lattice QCD language, simulations of that three-point function actually. Okay, technically it's sort of like an A plus two. Okay, it's a multi-point function, if you like, okay? Where we have the initial state, we have all these operators on different lattice sites, and then we have a final state. And what we do is we import and sample according to that matrix element, and then we do Motropolis algorithm to update the positions of the density operators. And so then at the end of the day, we actually get all A-body correlations that we want. So we can measure 3-particle correlations, 4-particle correlations, 10-particle correlations, and carbon-12. And so that's what we're going to use to map out the Hoyle states. They were very excited about this, because what you can do now is you can measure the three proton spin-up correlation function in three-dimensional space. Yeah?
Is that positive definite? Can you actually import them sampling into
The thing is, it's not positive definite. However, if the actual ground state wave function has pairing, then it'll be dominated by positive definite contributions. Yeah. Exactly. It's a good point. So that was what I was worried about, but the average sign actually turned out to
but I mean, for higher particle correlations.
Oh, well, what you do is you do a simulation for the full 8-body system. So if I do carbon 12, I'm doing a 12-body correlation thing. And then I just pick out whether I want a 1-body correlation relative to the center mass or 2-body. Yeah. The thing is, we're very excited about this, but however, the bad news is, I don't know how to do this for lattice QCD. Because for lattice QCD, you don't have quite the same closure relation in that in the many-body non-relativistic case, if I have an A-body density operator acting on an A-body state, I know what it does. It annihilates all the particles and it creates particles. And if I do an integral over all possible positions, it's going to be A, it gives me A factorial. In the relativistic lattice QCD case, there's not the same sort of thing that happens there. But maybe there's something else that can be worth. Yeah.
I just did a comment. It's all very interesting to look at the A-body density, but why not start with a simpler system that's already rich, maybe really made?
This is for A is for anything. So
well,
this,
of course, but I mean, yeah. why not see what you get, how this method works, what results you get for a simpler system?
Oh, yeah. We're going to start baby steps first. So we're just measuring charge density, radial correlations, one-body densities for alpha clusters and for helium-4. We'll do it for beryllium-8. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you can see the clustering in beryllium-8 as well. That should be pretty straightforward. But yeah, we'll use this for the Hoyle state, but we'll use it for other things as well. And then once we have an improvement of the Hoyle state description, we'll revisit the analysis of the light quark mass dependence, and we'll use the latest lattice QCD results at that time. And another thing I should mention, since it connects with the talk I gave earlier in this program, we had, since this analysis, we had looked at non-local versus local interactions, and we saw that there was actually a quantum phase transition that could be induced by changing whether you have local or non-local interactions. If you don't know what the heck I'm talking about, you can take a look at the talk I gave earlier in the program, or you can take a look at this paper. Now, I should mention connection with the light quark mass dependence. It seems unlikely that you can really change the range or the properties of the non-local interaction by changing the quark masses. And let me try to explain why. Because all the 1-pi exchange, 2-pi exchange, these produce local interactions, okay? The non-locality that you get at some fundamental level in the nucleon-nucleon interaction, that I would suspect actually comes about because of the compositeness of the nucleon. In other words, you have two nucleons, when they come close together, you don't know which quarks belong to which nucleon. And so, in principle, you get a non-local interaction even if you can't avoid it. So in some sense, you would expect that the non-locality, the non-local part of the interaction is coming from things related to the size of the proton, size of the neutron. And that probably is not affected very much by the pion. So even though there is this possible, this other degree of freedom we had not considered back in 2013, I suspect that this is not something you can tap by changing the quark masses, but that's something maybe we should look at. So anyways, that's all I prepared for today, so thanks.
Question about the UV cutoff.
Yeah.
I mean, your lattice spacing has been fixed so far, is that right?
Yeah.
Was it?
1.97 Fermi. So this is probably...
Are you sure that all the results are stable with respect to variations of that?
We know for lighter nuclei this is not an issue, but for the heavier systems in a couple years ago, we couldn't actually do smaller lattice spacings. We can now do that. And so this is something we can definitely do. So in the future, we hope to produce results where we have several lattice spacings in our simulations to show the control.
But of course, the lattice spacing shouldn't be too small.
Correct.
Because you would fall out
Correct.
Of the range of
Correct.
Applicability of the
exactly
effective
right.
theory.
Yeah, if it's too small, you get all kinds of things you really don't want in quantum many-body simulation, like spurious, deeply bound states that have nothing to do with nuclear physics, stuff like that. Yeah.
How big is the lattice you do now? How many points?
Oh, well, it depends on what we do. 6 cubed, 7 cubed, 8 cubed, 9 cubed, depending on.
9 cubed is the
yeah, like 8 cubed is typically what we.
Because we are trying to do this for cold atom, you know. And
yeah.
The oscillation becomes a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, yeah.
Just wondering how long you
can. Yeah, yeah. What helps a lot is that these are self-bound systems. And so once you get beyond the diameter of the nucleus, you really see no dependence at all. And so with cold atoms, then you have a gas that fills the box, and you want to make sure your correlations are exactly right. So yeah, there's some differences there. But I know exactly the problem. As you make your cold atom system bigger, you get ill-conditioned determinants that you have to calculate. It's an issue.
And another question is, you mentioned this quantum phase transition
yeah.
between what phase?
Oh, okay, yeah. So, I can explain it. So this is what I talked about. If you go back to like September, whenever I talked, you can look online. They videotape all these talks. But what we found was that by playing around with, what we did was a leading order calculation with one quantum exchange Coulomb plus a short range interaction, but not zero range, short range, but non-zero range. And we did simulations with non-local short range and local short range. Non-local meaning that the initial positions of the particles and the final positions of the particles could in general be different. So there's some movement of the particles in the interaction itself. Whereas local means they stay in place, like the Coulomb interaction. And what we found was that we can actually, by changing the locality to non-locality, we can induce a quantum phase transition from a nuclear liquid, basically nuclei droplets, to a Bose-Einstein condensate. We could essentially make the alpha-alpha interaction, the attraction that you typically get, we could turn that off by making the short-range interaction more non-local. And so that's what we played around with. And so you can play games and make the, you can tune it so that the alpha-alpha scattering without Coulomb is at the unitarity point, has infinite scattering length, and then the Hoyle state then can be connected to an Efimov trimer, which is kind of cool. Yeah.
One more short sure. question about the four-body force issue.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, Evgeny probably knows much more about that, but there have been some estimates, at least, of some subclasses of these processes, and they seem to be not so small, right? I mean, as far as I remember. The question in this context would be, I mean, if you get so pretty results now for the whole state, and the alpha clustering is the dominant phenomenon. Wouldn't you have to rethink all of it when you go to N3LO and put in four-body forces?
Yeah, well, generally we have tried to estimate the effects of the leading four-body force at N3LO. So in the standard delta less approach, you know, this four-body force is parameter 3, and we have calculated the expectation value in the alpha particle and found, you know, like several few hundreds of keV effect. It's sizable, but not really, you know, very large. So my expectation would be that, you know, if we would include alpha, if we would include the four-body force, it might produce similar effects, you know, on the alpha particle, but then the effects on the Hoyle state might be just 3 times. You know, the alpha particle contribution, since those observables are correlated. So I don't think that it will destroy the correlations, actually. And
yeah, wait.
So I think convergence is odd and it oscillates, and
yeah,
you
yeah.
almost get back in N2LO, what you started with.
This is great.
Why don't you get some better convergence?
Yeah, this is because we cheated at leading order. The leading order should have been actually much worse. But what we're doing is we're using perturbation theory for the next leading order, next leading order, kind of the way Bira sort of suggests you should do the calculation, perturbation theory. However, the thing is, if the perturbations don't converge very well, that doesn't work. So what we do is we make our starting point, the leading order, better than what it really should be. So we promote some stuff like the effective range corrections to the S waves. We promote that to leading order so that it's doing better. And as a result, instead of getting a, you know, you should have like a 20 MeV error on leading order, 10 MeV, and then 5. But what we did was we artificially made the leading order really quite good, so that's why it goes up and down.
Okay.
Thank you very much.